court wants all parties to know that this was a very difficult decision to make. This was not easy.
The subsistence fishermen trials continue in Bethel. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, residents of Circle clean up while Fort Yukon braces for Yukon River floods.
With all this water coming down the river, low-lying areas of Fort Yukon will likely see water go over the bank.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Today, the U.S. Coast Guard began a week-long probe of the grounding of the drilling rig Kulik last New Year's Day on an island south of Kodiak. The rig was being towed to Seattle when it broke loose in bad weather and ended up going aground. APRN Steve Heimel was at the hearing today at the Anchorage Assembly Chambers. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
There are so many questions about this incident, which put an end to Shell Oil's drilling plans in the Arctic for at least a year and probably two. Did we get any answers today, Steve?
Well, I think we got some answers to some of the smaller questions, but maybe not the really big ones. And the small ones would include, like, how did the tow get broken? Kind of an important question. It appears that there was a missing part on one of the shackles that was holding it, that was holding the Kulik to the tug, the Avik that was towing it. So that question definitely got answered, and a few others.
What are the other big questions still out there?
Well, the person who spoke today, they only got through one person and they're going to bring him back, was Norman T. Custard. He was the team leader for Shell. And he basically was in charge of all of it. He's the guy that made the decision to cut it loose and let it go aground, made the decision to call the Coast Guard in to rescue the 18 people aboard the Kulik because he was in fear for their safety. And he also approved the towing plan. So he was the man. But whether we got a clear answer on why they decided to do the tow when they did, all he said really was that we had a towing plan and I approved it. But later on, we'll hear from the technical people as to exactly how that decision was made, how the weather played into it and all that. We also don't know why the four engines failed on the Avik, and that's rather an important question.
What happens next at the hearings?
Well, they're going to go to the contractor who did the towing next, who will join by teleconference, and then they're going to go back and talk to Mr. Custard some more, and they have this stuff planned on through the week.
Do you expect the hearing to wrap up this week, or did you get a sense of that?
Well, they do like to quit a little bit early, but my feeling is that there are so many lawyers there who get a chance to do cross-examination and so forth that this is going to definitely drag into next week.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
APRN Steve Heimel is covering the Coast Guard probe of the Kulik grounding. Residents of Circle are cleaning up after an ice jam on the Yukon River caused extensive flooding in the community yesterday. Circle First Chief Jessica Boyle says the ice started breaking up around 3 a.m. Sunday, jammed downstream, and sent water over a 25-foot seawall along the Yukon River.
Came over the seawall, came up onto the roads, just totally engulfed the whole downtown area of Circle.
Boyle says about 15 homes were flooded, some getting as much as 3 feet of water.
Most of the houses in the downtown area did get water in it. And then a couple came off their foundation and floated into the woods behind where their house originally was.
Boyle says a community hall on higher ground is providing housing for some, while others have taken refuge with friends whose homes were not flooded. She says a community of about 80 people is a mess.
There's ice chunks on the roads. It's pretty muddy, pretty messy. There's a strong smell of diesel and gas in the downtown area. Our church got flooded. Our clinic got flooded. It looks pretty rough.
Circle's electric generator is working, and Boyle says the community has a 5,000-gallon holding tank that's providing fresh water, but there's concern the city well may be contaminated. A flood warning has been issued downstream at Fort Yukon. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says aerial surveillance indicates the village will likely experience high water.
We're expecting the break up front to push past Fort Yukon sometime later today. And with all this water coming down the river, low-lying areas of Fort Yukon will likely see water go over the bank.
Plum says the big concern is that strong ice below Fort Yukon will result in a jam. The Kuskokwim fishermen trial resumed today in Bethel. Last June, about 50 fishermen were cited for illegal salmon fishing. Half of them pleaded not guilty and have been fighting it in court ever since. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
In recent weeks, the fishermen have been waiting to hear a decision on whether they have the religious right to subsistence fish, even during state closures. They packed into the courtroom with some people left standing in the hallway. It was a trial by judge, and Judge Bruce Ward, in a gentle voice, said the court found that the state's need to restrict king salmon supersedes the fishermen's right to religious practice.
The court wants all parties to know that this was a very difficult decision to make. This was not easy.
The fishermen were challenging the state based on a free exercise clause of the Alaska Constitution, arguing that subsistence fishing is a religious practice and that when they fished last summer during closures, they were practicing their religion. Judge Ward said he did a lot of research, including looking at an older case, Frank versus the State, which was decided by the Alaska Supreme Court in 1979. That case shows that the free exercise clause may work when three things are met. One, religion is involved. Two, when the conduct is religiously based. And three, the person is sincere. The court found that the defendants met the first two no problem. It was obvious from the expert testimony the court heard on Yupik culture. The sincerity question would be addressed later by individual trials. The sticking point came when Western science entered into the argument. Based on the testimony given by state and federal fish biologists last month, the court decided that there is a compelling need to restrict the Kuskokwim king run based on recent data. Where in the Frank case, it was about the need to take one moose for a ceremonial potlatch, which wouldn't have affected the population of moose, in this case, the fishing could have had an adverse effect.
Therefore, this court finds the need to police the Chinook run to ensure its continuity for future generations of Yupik fishermen and families overcomes the argued for free exercise exemption, which would otherwise apply.
Although each case must be heard separately for the court to determine the fisherman's sincerity, Judge Ward said those findings won't sway his guilty verdicts. That held true in the first trials against fishermen Felix Flynn and Peter Hines. Both had their nets seized last summer, and both got emotional on the stand. Flynn wiped tears away, saying that it had been hard answering questions from his young grandson.
He asked me, when are we going to go check the net? I couldn't say nothing, because we didn't have no net out there. But he witnessed me when we set the net. And that's really painful.
So far, the court is finding that all the fishermen were sincere in their religious beliefs, but is finding them guilty anyway. Most are being sentenced $500 with half of it suspended and put on probation for 1 year. The defense, led by James Davis Jr. with the Northern Justice Project, plans to appeal, and the judge says the Alaska Supreme Court should review the Frank case.
I think the Alaska Supreme Court needs to address some of the parameters that were outlined in Frank 40 years ago. It's been a long time. And the situation in this case is very different for a number of reasons.
At some point during the proceeding, the courtroom was infused with the smell of dry fish as someone in the gallery passed around a gallon baggie full of it, sharing it with everyone. The individual trials will continue at the Bethel Courthouse until all remaining fishermen are heard. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new push for opening ANWR.
We'd rather have onshore development because that's more responsible development than offshore.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Pavlov volcano continued to erupt over the weekend, spitting a plume of ash that reached 22,000 feet into the sky. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, that's not enough to affect international air traffic, but it's enough to stop regional air service to Western Alaska.
Ryan Karakaburu oversees operations at Penn Air. He says on Monday morning the airline canceled flights to
Dutch, King Salmon, Dillingham, and the Pribilof.
There's also Sand Point, which hasn't had air service since Thursday. Overall, Penn Air has completely shut down its Alaska operations. A representative for Grant Aviation says cancellations are also possible for their service to King Salmon. The problem is that Pavlov Volcano's ash cloud is being blown into the flight path between Anchorage and Southwest Alaska. It's not a threat to navigation, but as Karakaburu from Penn Air says,
well, it's very damaging to the engines if you ingest ash.
Planes won't fly again until the low-pressure system over the region lifts and the ash dissipates. Down on the ground, the Aleutian fishing port of Sand Point has been getting the brunt of the ash fall for the past few days. The wind finally shifted Sunday, giving Sand Point a break. But according to the Alaska Volcano Observatory, Pavlov hasn't let up at all. It's still shooting large jets of ash and steam. So the only difference is that now, the more northern villages of Nelson Lagoon and Port Moeller are in the line of fire instead. Merle Brandel lives in Nelson Lagoon. He says ash is falling there, mixed in with rain.
And I see the bottom of the windowsill outside there, so it's black, you know, with the black ash, and it's real sticky.
Brandel says most people in Nelson Lagoon are trying to stay inside to avoid contact. They've stopped up on food and fuel, along with water. That last part has been a bit tricky. Brandel operates the village's water treatment plant, and he says he stopped pumping fresh water into the storage tank since the eruption started to protect the supply. For now, Nelson Lagoon is getting by on reserves.
Hopefully, you know, within a week or 2 weeks or month or whatever, we can pop the tanks back off, you know, comfortably without putting any ash in for holding tanks.
If they're careful, Brandel says Nelson Lagoon should have enough water to last another 2 months of volcanic eruptions. By that time, though, he says he hopes life will have gotten back to normal. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Governor Sean Parnell says he's willing to ask the state legislature for $50 million in next year's budget to discover the true volume of oil in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, any movement hinges on federal action.
Governor Parnell says the state aims to do both wintertime exploration and 3D seismic testing on the coastal plain of Anwar. The $50 million the state would pony up covers a third of the cost. The state is banking on the federal government and private industry to come up with the rest. Governor Parnell says the federal government, under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, needs to survey the resource potential.
The federal government cannot legitimately evaluate impacts unless it knows the breadth of the oil and gas resources it stands to recover for Americans' benefit. President Obama has also recognized the need to use comprehensive information when making decisions in the Arctic. So let's get that information.
Parnell is in Alaska and Monday morning teleconferenced into a gathering of business interests at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the nation's largest business lobbying group. On hand in Washington, D.C. to make the pitch is Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan. He says the Interior Department is preparing its Anwar management plan, and from what he hears, it will not include expanded oil and gas drilling.
The six alternatives that are in their comprehensive Anwar management plan, not one of them mentions anything to do with assessing oil and gas in the coastal plain, not one.
Congress has repeatedly blocked drilling in Anwar. Last year, the House passed a bill opening a segment of the wildlife refuge, only to see it garner a slim 41 votes in the Senate. Three Democrats, including Senator Mark Begich, voted for that amendment, but seven Republicans voted against it. Commissioner Sullivan, a former state attorney general, says state lawyers don't know whether it's legal to proceed with the seismic testing without congressional okay.
Whether a full exploration program could fit with under the authority of ANILCA or would require additional congressional authority, we're not 100% sure. That's the reason why we're presenting this proposal both to the Department of Interior and to Congress.
He says the state told the Interior Department Friday it was releasing the plan. Sullivan says he'll discuss the seismic testing with Deputy Secretary of the Interior David Hayes this week.
You know, when we've had a discussion with the federal government on this issue. There's a bit of a head in the sand, head in the tundra view where, no, they don't want to know anymore.
Talk about wasting taxpayers' dollars.
That's Cindy Shogan. She's the executive director of the Alaska Wilderness League. She says the plan smacks of politics, that the state is trying to force Congress's hand. And on top of that, she says the federal government has made clear any development requires congressional approval.
It would take an act of Congress to do any exploration or leasing or development of the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. So it's illegal.
Also in D.C. promoting the plan are Alaska Native leaders, including North Slope Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower. Brower says the borough has consistently pushed for onshore development.
We'd rather have onshore development because that's more responsible development than offshore. And so that's important for us.
Anwar is located in the borough, and Koktovik is the only village in Anwar. For years, residents there have debated whether development in the refuge is a good thing. Officials with the Department of Interior did not return calls for comment, but their management plan is rumored to be complete, but there's no set publication date. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Former Republican U.S. Senate nominee Joe Miller has not yet said if he will appeal an award of court costs to an internet news organization that sued to get his personnel records in 2010. Judge Stephanie Joannidis ruled that Miller should pay $85,000 and the Fairbanks North Star Borough $12,500 to the Alaska Dispatch and its attorney John McKay. Miller has a federal campaign committee with a $425,000 war chest, but has not declared any candidacy. In his 2010 Senate race, he ran against Democrat Scott McAdams, but both were overwhelmed by a write-in victory by Lisa Murkowski, who had been defeated by Miller in the primary.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Nearly 2,000 people turned out in Ketchikan Saturday afternoon to break the Guinness World Record for the largest rain boot race. KRBD's Layla Carey was among them and has this report.
Follow the sound of my voice. We'll get you registered and in position.
According to official U.S. Census records, Ketchikan's population is just shy of 13,800 people. That's the whole borough, not just the city. A couple hundred at a time will get together for plays or concerts, but it's very rare, perhaps unprecedented, in the community's history for nearly 2,000 people in Ketchikan to congregate in one place at one time for a single purpose. But on a beautiful afternoon with just a sprinkling of rain to get people in the proper mood before the clouds lifted, it happened. A sea of people, all wearing rain boots, gathered, mingled, talked, laughed, sang, and finally walked, a few ran, to break a record. The previous record for what's officially known as the largest Wellington boot race was held by the British county of Lincolnshire, which is about a two-hour drive from London. That county broke the record in 2009, when 1,366 people marched a mile in their wellies. Ketchikan's race more than met that challenge. The number announced after the race, while not confirmed yet by Guinness, was 1,976. As the crowd gathered at the starting line, the city's mayor stood by, ready to kick off the race.
Mayor Lou Williams III, how'd they rope you into this?
They gave me a gun.
He didn't have to wait long to shoot it.
Are you guys ready?
Yeah!
Go!
It's been said, and evidence seems to prove, that Ketchikan residents will use any excuse to dress in costume. So it seemed natural for a few superheroes to find their way into the crowd.
So okay. What made you decide to dress up like Wonder Woman for the Extra Tough Race?
Well, we are breaking a world record, right? And that's something that Wonder Woman does in everyday average. So why not, right?
And then there were some ducks.
Can you quack for me?
Adding to the festive atmosphere, a trumpet serenaded walkers at the halfway mark. It wasn't just local folk walking in the race. People came from neighboring islands to help break the record, and some came from much farther. Femke Borsma and Kelly Bremer are here from the Netherlands visiting a friend. Borsma says it was good timing.
So we were very excited that the race was just during our time here, because we are here for 6 days. But, you know, we feel like we traveled all the way from our own little rainy country to set this record, so.
At the end of the short trek along Ketchikan's 3rd Avenue, volunteers collected wristbands proving that each participant officially completed the race. The bands, along with other evidence, will be shipped to Guinness headquarters in New York for confirmation of Ketchikan's accomplishment. But we all know we did it.
Great big round of applause, please.
In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
New Ixit is both one of the newest communities on the North Slope and one of the oldest. The area was inhabited for centuries by the Inupiat and then abandoned for Barrow. In 1973, former community members decided to resettle the area and build a village far from the bustle of the regional hub. But just 25 years later, the bustle came to them in the form of Alpine Oil Field. For our series on culture in Alaska, APRN contributor Ann Hillman found out how the oil company and the community have learned to communicate with one another.
Elder Lydia Solvovic grew up in the Colville Delta, home to the modern-day community of New Ixit.
I always have dog team. I have fun with my dog team. Hunting squirrel, hunting ptarmigan.
Her family was one of the last to leave the area in 1948 for Barrow, a larger town with schools. When they lived in Barrow, she worked as a waitress in different restaurants. But eventually, it became too much.
Too much alcohol. That's how come we want to move back here. Too much. Can't stay dry over there.
So they joined a group that wanted to reestablish a settled community in the Delta. She arrived in New Ixit on the back of a snow machine in 1973 and moved into a tent with her children and the rest of the new settlers. Now, New Ixit boasts perfectly straight streets lined with wooden houses, a school, a store, churches, an airport, and oil. Elder Joe Napakiak says his ancestors knew about oil in the region.
They have known these natural oil seepage around the tundra. So they would come to some of the certain places where there's oil seep, and they might, in those years, they would go dig up well-soaked tundra and use it to heat their tile houses and whatever that may require of them.
But Napakiak says that's not why people returned to the area. They came for the hunting and the fishing, the same things their ancestors sought in the region. Within 25 years of the founding of New Ixit in the 1990s, the subsistence-based community had to start thinking about oil development. James Tulloch is the cultural coordinator for the city of New Ixit. He says when oil companies first came to the area, they didn't bother to communicate with the local residents.
Coming to a small community to do a meeting, you know, back then, it wouldn't have been a thought. But these days, it's mandatory.
Alpine Oil Field sits 8 miles from the community of New Ixit. It was the first major development near the community, and ConocoPhillips first started commercially producing oil there in 2001. They run 3 other sites in the Colville Delta. Other companies, like Pioneer Natural Resources, operate fields in the vicinity. Tulloch, sitting in the bustling but tiny city office, says that when the oil companies began reaching out to the community, they were in for a surprise.
I think it's a culture shock to a lot of the outsiders. You know, They're used to set times, given times, you know, appointments, and making sure that they're either early or on time for these appointments and deadlines. You know, you come to a community here like New Ixit, and I can think anywhere in rural Alaska villages, I mean, they realize that, okay, maybe you're right. I should slow down and just take it easy, you know. Soak in the day, you know.
He says they also had to learn about different mannerisms. Eye contact is less important in Inupiaq culture. People raise their eyebrows to say yes. And the Inupiaq had to learn about the outsiders and their fast ways and sometimes confusing body language. But over time, and through cross-cultural education by the city, both sides came up to speed.
But I think on all sides, at least for Inuits that I can speak for, I think, you know, I think that bridge has been crossed where, you know, we're able to communicate just as well with them at their speed as they are with us.
To help maintain the bridge between the community and the oil companies, some businesses, such as Pioneer Natural Resources, attend the annual Nluqqatuq festivals each summer and dance with the community during the festival's closing. Pioneer, which operates a small oil field from a man-made island 2.5 miles offshore, provides a barbecue at the event that celebrates the yearly whale harvest. Dale Hoff, a senior land manager with Pioneer, says they also require all of the workers to attend orientation sessions about the local culture, whaling, and sensitive parts of the Arctic environment.
It's important to our company because really the people of Nuiqsut are our closest neighbor. We're about 25 miles away from their village, which seems like a long way to many people, but in the Arctic it's pretty close, and we'd like to maintain the respect for these, you know, for the community here, as well as have them understand what we do. And we've had people out to the island to see how we operate, and we've got a good working relationship with everybody here in the village.
And James Tollick, who helps coordinate some of the cross-cultural meetings, agrees that the companies are much more respectful than they used to be. But that doesn't mean that the entire community is completely happy with oil development in the area. Multiple elders said that the pipelines changed where the caribou herd travels. The animals don't come as close to the community anymore, making hunting harder. And the hunting grounds of their ancestors were the reason that many of them came back. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Ann Hillman in Nuiqsut. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.